This month, the science fiction writer Robert J. Sawyer published his 25th book. It's called The Downloaded. It's a mix of Rob's trademark combo of science and ethics wrapped in a suspenseful story. His books have won an armload of awards, and he's a tireless advocate for science fiction writing. And in The Downloaded, two groups of characters are cryogenically preserved and their minds uploaded to a computer. One of the preserved pods is astronauts heading to a distant star, and the other is a group of convicts serving out their sentences in virtual reality. When both groups are brought back, quite abruptly to reality, they find themselves in a world vastly changed from what they expected. Here to explain it all and do a much better job at it than I can is the longtime sci-fi writer Robert J. Sawyer. Hi, Robert. Welcome back to The Next Chapter.
What a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Through the initial segments of this book, we learn about cryogenics. We meet some of the characters who have had this happen to them. And I was interested. First of all, I was so excited to understand everything in this book. I always have this fear of science fiction that I'm not going to get it. But I found it very compelling. And I was interested to learn that freezing the body and saving the brain are two different things. Tell us about that.
Well, this is my postulate that they're two different things. There has been a business for decades now, for over 40 years, of cryogenically, that means at extremely cold temperatures, freezing human remains in the hope that at some point down the road, there's going to be a cure for whatever killed you, whether it's cancer, a heart attack, whatever. And the assumption has been that if they can cure whatever is wrong with the body and somehow reanimate the body, that the brain will reanimate too. And your consciousness, maybe if you're religiously inclined, your soul will re-inhabit this thawed out form. I'm not at all sure that that is true. I think, you know, there's a big debate in philosophy, they call it dualism, whether or not the mind and the body are separate things. Mm. And for many, many years, the notion that they were separate things was poo-pooed by neuroscientists and poo-pooed by philosophers. No. It's all one substance. But I think we're actually finding more and more evidence that consciousness is something separate from physicality. Mm. And so in my novel, I explore the idea that you have to preserve the body in one place and preserve the mind in another place.
As I was reading this, I was also watching something on Netflix called The Three-Body Problem.
By my friend – well, I mean, it's the adaptation of my friend Lou Cixin's novel,
yeah.
The Three-Body Problem.
Yeah.
Lou and I were just co-guests of honor at the 81st World Science Fiction Convention. I've known him since 2007. But yes, he is also exploring some very interesting stuff.
Exactly right. I don't want to ruin anything for
somebody. No spoilers for him. Or for The Downloaded, please.
Or for The Downloaded. So it was very interesting that there was, you know, parallels there at the very same. It was serendipitous that both these things.
Yeah, you know, a lot of these ideas are in the air. And the cryogenic freezing is real technology. I mean, it really exists. But this is a business, and I have a line in The Downloaded about it, where they get, you know, 4-star reviews or 5-star reviews for every aspect of their service. Groundskeeping, the staff is nice, everything. But the one thing they actually purport to do that they've charged you a lot of money, they've never done.
Right.
No one has ever intentionally thawed out a cryogenically frozen body. The sad truth is, often enough, some of the companies have not had good funding or have had power failures, and people who've paid to have their bodies frozen, they've thawed out partially or completely, which means the damage is irreparable at that point. So it's a very dicey technology, at least currently.
Sure. I am on pins and needles waiting to see what happens with Walt Disney.
Well, that's right. Yeah, yes. And, you know, anybody who's even remotely a science fiction fan is familiar with Matt Groening's Futurama series.
Sure.
With all the preserved heads in the jars, which is, you know, a version of this cryogenic suspension. And that goes back to what you said at the very beginning, the body separate from the brain.
Hmm. I talked about the two groups at the beginning, right? So that other group of frozen people are murderers who are serving their time in a sped up reality with the promise that when they get out, their minds will have done the time, but their bodies haven't
exactly.
aged. How did that idea come to you?
So, you know, I was very fortunate. In fact, I'm just about to start my book tour for The Downloaded. Mm. And years ago, I went to a writer's festival on a previous book tour in Whitehorse in the Yukon. And they said, you know, we do this thing. We have authors go to visit prisoners in the jail in Whitehorse. Would you like to do that for a day? What a fascinating experience. Everybody there has a story to tell. But what was apparent to me is how devastating it was, not necessarily being in jail, although that's an awful thing, but knowing that your children are growing up, knowing that your spouse is getting older, and when you come out, knowing that whatever job you were trained for, your skill set is going to be hopelessly obsolete. You do 20 years in jail. Imagine the jobs of 20 years ago. There was no such thing as social media manager. There's no such thing as so many of the jobs we do mm-hmm. today. So if you could get in and do your time, but get out without the time passing in the real world, it would be, I think, a good thing for the prisoner and a good thing for society. And I thought that was an interesting prospect to play with. Okay. And I've got to say just very quickly, Ideas did a series many years ago. David Cayley did it for Ideas called here on CBC Radio called Prison and Its Alternatives. And that also really kickstarted my thinking about this. And I said that to David just a little while ago. David, I don't know if you remember the series. Well, of course, he remembers it, but you did 20 years ago. But I've incorporated a lot of thinking from that Ideas series into this novel, The Downloaded.
And then David asked you for some cash?
Yeah. He's got a CBC pension, so it can't be that good.
The prisoners, they experience this kind of hell, but the astronauts who think they're on the way to a distant star, they create their own kind of virtual heaven in a way during their upload.
Exactly, to pass the time.
To pass the time. So why ever leave that for the hard, cold reality?
Well, and this is, a question I think that we're all kind of facing. This novel is very much my COVID-19 novel. I wrote it during COVID, but also when we started COVID, we metaphorically all uploaded. We stopped going into the office. We telecommuted. We stopped seeing our friends. We saw them on Zoom or we saw them on Facebook Messenger video or whatever. Mm. We stopped interacting physically. And for a lot of people, the reverse of that, when we have to download backing, oh, you got to go back to the office? Wait a minute. I don't want to go back to the office. Mm. I kind of enjoyed not having to do all those social obligations that I felt I had to do during COVID. So I wanted to play with that notion of, as science fiction always does, metaphorically something that's real. The real thing is we're all downloading back into reality now that the COVID-19 crisis is finally, by and large, behind us. And so my astronauts are faced with that question. I kind of like this life where I didn't have to go to the office, where I could do whatever I want, where nobody knew that I was working with no pants on at home, right? And I really think for many of us, that transition has been very difficult going back to the real world. And it also is for some of my astronauts.
We both have our pants on. I should just let
we should know. Absolutely and, say yeah. that. Even though it's radio, absolutely.
We're in person.
Actually, I can't see that you do. You're on the other side of the desk. But I guarantee for my readers and listeners, I do.
I'll keep mine a mystery.
All right.
VR, again, also three-body problem, a huge part of that. And so, again, I was thinking of this, this idea of virtual reality today and what's being developed and how lifelike and real it will become. Do you think a similar thing will happen where people don't want to leave virtual reality for reality?
I think it's absolutely true. I mean, I look at lots of people today who are out at fascinating places, whether it's just a restaurant with a good dinner companion or beautiful places in nature, and they're glued to their phone. They, in essence, have already chosen the online life versus the offline life. There's all of the physicality, all of the sensory experiences all around them, and yet they want to be glued to that tiny little piece of Gorilla Glass in their hand.
Yeah. Digging into the book a little bit more, when all your characters wake up, they discover that they are 500 years in the future, and that is much longer than what they originally had planned for. And but there's also been an apocalypse. and humans have been virtually wiped out. I don't think these are spoilers. These happened early enough.
This is the setup.
Yeah. So overall, not a good time for them to wake up. Tell us what happened.
Yeah. So they assume initially, I won't give away what it turns out to be, they assume initially that the sun had done a thing, which the sun does from time to time, called a coronal mass ejection, which is a whole bunch of plasma and highly charged particles and electromagnetic junk noise coming out of the sun like a big belch from our star.
Coming off the heels of a solar eclipse days ago, it feels
well, that's
very timely
right.
to
yes,
talk about
that's
this.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And it could wipe out all of our technology when something like that happens. And actually, in the novel, I took a kernel from Mike Lazaridis, who is the co-founder of Research in Motion, now known as BlackBerry, co-inventor of the world's first smartphone, because their headquarters is in Waterloo, Ontario.
Yeah, Lazaridis Hall is a
absolutely
on the campus
that's right.
there. Yeah, of course.
And my novel is set in Waterloo, and because I'm lucky enough to be friends with Mike Lazaridis, we were having dinner maybe 15 years ago, and I said to Mike, I was kind of being a little cheeky. I said, Mike, why did you found your company in Waterloo, Ontario, when you're surrounded by old order Mennonites, by a customer, potential customer base that would never use your product?
Yeah.
And Mike said, and it stuck with me for 15 years, he said, are you kidding? They're the backup plan for humanity. When all of this, meaning technological civilization, crumbles, they're going to sail on fine. It won't affect them at all. And I thought, wow. And so he wanted to be very close to the Mennonites, right, rather than far away from them. And that became one of the pillars of the novel, because there also are, besides the astronauts and the convicts, the third group, the only survivors in the at least Kitchener-Waterloo area, are old order Mennonites, and they figure very prominently in the book as well.
With all these sort of credits you're giving to different people who help influence the book, it feels like it takes a village to write a science fiction.
It takes a village. Yeah. You know, I mean, I consider my job to be a sponge for everything, including personality quirks of people, you know, little bits. I'm listening to the way they talk, whatever conversations they have. When I'm in a restaurant and the couple behind me is having a fight, I lean back and go, oh, that's good. I can use that. But also for everything in science, technology, philosophy, religion, literature, whatever, and every good idea that people are, you know, have around me, my job is to synthesize that into hopefully something that not just a science fiction fan can read, but that anybody can read. I want to be an accessible writer of science fiction.
There's a very human element, Lord of the Flies-ish almost, in the book, where the convicts and the astronauts are forced to come together, elect a mayor, organize a government, this kind of thing. The convict gets elected and proves himself to be a good mayor. What landed him in prison? Let's talk about that character.
So the character's name is Roscoe Kedulian, and he had been tormented, as I must say I was, as a child by bullies. And he found that in his adult life that he was being bullied online again by anonymous accounts. And he did a little searching and discovered that the anonymous bully who was after him today was the same bully who had been after him as he was a kid, now grown up. And he decides he's going to go to where that guy lives, confront him and say, you ruined my childhood and I'll be darned if you get to ruin my adulthood. Mm. Gets out of hand, and he stabs the guy with garden shears. Had no weapon on him, no intention of doing violence, but he just goes nuts. And yes, he killed a guy. He killed a guy, maybe even deserved to not be around anymore. But nonetheless, justice requires that he serve a sentence. And the whole point of prison, for the prisoner's point of view, is to be rehabilitation. We do a terrible job of that. Almost none of our prison rehabilitation efforts succeed, but I wanted to postulate a version of this guy's life story where given 20 years to think about his crime and access to psychology books, sociology books, all kinds of information that he could learn to be a better person and come out the other end. And he does. He very much is, if there's a hero to the downloaded, a main character, it's this Roscoe Kedulian convict.
I did like the way that you said, you know, he had a daughter that he was able to see on the weekends. You gave him stakes. It wasn't somebody with nothing to lose.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. That's right. He has a young daughter. And if he, you know, his sentence is passing at a high speed in virtual reality, he'll be out still while it's a young daughter, not while she's a, you know, an old woman. Mm-hmm. So, and also I wanted to contrast, one of the big things I wanted to do in the novel was contrast the astronauts who have the quote unquote right stuff with the prisoners who definitionally have the wrong stuff by, you know, according to the law. But that right stuff that is so celebrated in the movie The Right Stuff and Thomas Wolfe's nonfiction book The Right Stuff is, in my way of thinking, very much toxic masculinity. It is all the wrong stuff. It's hyper-competitiveness. It's hair-trigger temper. It's this incredible sense of pride, and if you have disrespected me, I have to knock you down. And I really had a lot of joy in contrasting who people thought would be the virtuous heroes, the astronauts, with who they thought would be the despicable villains, the prisoners, and turning it the other way around for a bunch of the characters.
I want to sort of wrap this up with this idea that you're a Star Trek fan from way back. I was blessed, honored to have a role in this latest version of Star Trek. I mean, one episode of it.
Are you in Discovery or Strange New Worlds?
Strange New Worlds. I wanted to ask you about a quote from the show that you have on page 139 of the book. What is that?
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, which is the mantra from Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, where Spock sacrifices himself to save the 429 other crew members of the Starship Enterprise. Absolutely. We have a tendency to be very selfish in life and forget that very simple philosophy, which is the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. If you are inconvenienced even to the point of, I'm sorry, you got to sacrifice yourself for the good of the many, that's possibly the ultimate human virtue. And Star Trek, if it's about anything, and I think my brand of optimistic science fiction, if it's about anything, is about looking for the best, the optimistic, the, not just what Homo sapiens is today, but all the wonderful things Homo sapiens can be in all the tomorrows ahead.
What a wonderful way to wrap up the interview. Thank you, Robert. And I'll tell you again, I mean, it was a reminder reading this book that you should never write off a genre because you think you're not built for it. And I think I did that many years ago, thinking that I'm just not smart enough for this. You made me feel smarter, and I really enjoyed the book. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Robert J. Sawyer is the author of The Downloaded. He spoke with me in the Toronto studio.